This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 18th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 195. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the Big Deal feature, the latest from Mario Canseco of Research Co. But first, Is It Just Me? Is it just me, or... In his 1991 bestseller, Parliament of Horrors, humorist P.J. O'Rourke used his sharp wit to explain the United States government. But many of his observations could easily apply to any of the countries in the G7, including Canada. O'Rourke famously wrote that, quote, "Every government is a parliament of horrors. The trouble is, in a democracy, the horrors are us," end quote. Justin Trudeau is getting ready to prove that again. Instead of waiting until the pandemic is over, instead of waiting for the fixed election date in October 2023, Trudeau is planning to call a snap election in mid-August. The Trudeau Liberals might be Canada's most corrupt government ever, but the polls say the celebrity prime minister is popular, so why not try for a majority? The day after recording a campaign ad in North Vancouver, Trudeau came to Surrey on July 9th to promise $1.3 billion for the SkyTrain to Langley. Surrey Mayor Doug McCallum was giddy. In 2018, he promised that switching from light rail to SkyTrain would only cost $1.65 billion. He told voters not to trust the $2.9 billion estimate from TransLink. A plurality, not a majority, of voters elected McCallum. His Safe Surrey Coalition Party won the council majority, they scrapped LRT, and guess what? McCallum begged Ottawa for more money for SkyTrain. Sitting near Trudeau and McCallum at the announcement was Premier John Horgan, who broke BC's fixed election date law last fall for an election that gave the NDP more power and put BC behind the eight ball in the pandemic. Horgan bribed voters with their own money, $1,000 per family, $500 for individuals. It's a sad reality. Every government is a parliament of horrors. The trouble is, in a democracy, the horrors are us. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Hong Kong Free Press, worst year so far. Hong Kong press freedoms are in tatters, says Union. The past year is definitely the worst year so far for press freedom, said Ronson Chan, chairman of the Hong Kong Journalist Association, as the union published its annual report. Authors pointed to the forced closure of Beijing critical tabloid Apple Daily, public broadcaster RTHK becoming a government propaganda apparatus, and restrictions on searching public databases. In the Japan Times, Pfizer vaccine crunch continues to trouble Japan's inoculation efforts. Starting in August, during the Summer Olympics, the central government will set aside a certain quantity of Pfizer doses that prefectures can distribute to municipalities that need them the most. The move comes amid simmering frustrations among some municipalities that their rollout schedule has been thrown into disarray due to a shortage of doses. For the first 2 weeks of August, the government is slated to deliver 11.7 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine nationwide. In the Korea Times, government may strengthen distancing rules in non-Seoul regions, says the PM. Prime Minister Kim Boo-kyum hinted at enforcing stronger social distancing rules in regions outside the Greater Seoul area as the country struggles to contain the fourth wave of the pandemic. Kim said that authorities could strengthen the private gathering restrictions after 6 p.m. in non-Seoul regions when new virus cases continue to rise. Most regions outside the wider capital area have been placed under Level 2 measures, in which gatherings of more than 8 people are banned. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Governor Kate Brown all but disappeared during Oregon's deadly heat wave. Here's where she spent the hottest day. Governor Kate Brown spent the third and hottest day of Oregon's deadly June heat wave at a day-long retreat at a Yamhill County winery. The governor stuck with a scheduled June 28th strategic planning meeting with top staffers in wine country as Oregonians confronted deadly temperatures that killed more than 100. The state's top elected leader failed to understand and failed to communicate to the public the gravity of the heat emergency. National Weather Service recorded a 46 degrees Celsius high in Portland on June 28th. Brown never spoke directly to Oregonians about the dire situation. In the Times Colonist, Ben Isaac resigns position on CRD Indigenous Committee as Pachidit raised concerns. Victoria Councillor Ben Isaac has resigned as Vice Chair of the Capital Regional District's Indigenous Relations Committee after the Pachidit First Nation said his deeply offensive behavior showed that the nation cannot trust the Capital Regional District. Online video shows Isaac arguing with RCMP officers and a tow truck driver about whether it was legal to remove vehicles from an area near Port Renfrew where people were protesting old-growth logging. The video shows Isaac telling the tow truck driver the situation is unsafe and he has the right to refuse unsafe work. He also offered the man cash. Meanwhile, Vancouver City Councillor Gene Swanson joined a July 14th protest in favor of legalizing hard drugs for addicts. Swanson gave away heroin, cocaine, and meth in front of a Vancouver police station. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Federal sources tell me that August 16th is circled on calendars. More than 2 years before the next legislated election date, the middle Monday of August, is expected to be the day that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau goes to ask new Governor General Mary Simon to call an election. All signs point to a federal election in September. More than a week ago, Trudeau came to the West Coast for daycare and transit spending photo ops in Coquitlam and Surrey and a campaign ad shoot in North Vancouver. I'm welcoming back to the Breaker.News podcast frequent guest Mario Canseco of ResearchGo to talk federal politics and BC trends. What do you think will be the issue of this election, and what do you think could be the outcome?
The Liberals will try to turn this into a referendum on pandemic handling. The numbers have been trending upward for the past few months. The last time we asked, we saw 61% of Canadians were satisfied with how the federal government has handled this pandemic. The numbers are higher in Atlantic Canada and Quebec, areas where the Liberals usually do well. And the road to the majority government, in a way, passes through British Columbia. And even though they've been a little bit better in Alberta and in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, there's no guarantee that the level of support will garner them the seats that they're seeking. Still way ahead in Ontario. And essentially, this is trying to figure out a way to replicate what happened with the governments of Saskatchewan and British Columbia last year. They called elections, one of them early, the other one not. The hope that people would be satisfied with how the COVID-19 pandemic was going at the time, and they were rewarded with larger majorities than the ones they had. What's interesting about this as well, if we looked at the historical numbers, it would essentially replicate the first three elections of Pierre Elliott Trudeau. He wins his majority in 1968, then has a minority government after the 1972 election, and then 2 years later, he regains his majority mandate. Similar situation for Justin Trudeau. The first election in 2015, majority, 4 years later, minority, 2 years later, he's aching to get that majority government, which could definitely happen because of the fact that we haven't really seen a lot of support for the Conservatives and not a lot of identification with federal Conservative leader Erin O'Toole at this point.
The pandemic has prevented Conservative leader Erin O'Toole from taking a coast-to-coast tour to meet average Canadians and party faithful. Party faithful are nervous that O'Toole may not be the guy who can knock off Trudeau. But remember 2017 when NDP members in BC were feeling the same way about John Horgan? And as we know, campaigns matter.
Yeah.
Is this just a matter of pre-campaign jitters?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects that are going to be crucial for the Conservatives if they want to do better than in the last election. One of them is definitely trying to raise the recognition of the leader as somebody who they can relate to. Right now, the numbers haven't been great. Every month, we see more people who go from undecided to having an unfavorable view of Erin O'Toole, and that is definitely something that they need to counter on the campaign. The other issue that is quite tricky in this sense is the sentiment from the voters who have to be really motivated to come out and cast a ballot for the Conservatives. If we wind up in a campaign similar to the one we had in 2000 when the Jan Chrétien Liberal Party decided to take advantage of Stockwell Day's newness into the scene, and as the campaign rolled along, we continued to see how it was definitely going to be a Liberal victory. And that essentially made the Canadian Alliance voter uneasy about actually heading out and casting a ballot in late November. Why do this? Why don't we just stay home? And it ended up being a very massive victory for the Liberals. And we could be heading into a similar scenario if we start to see a trend where the Liberals are leading by a large margin and the Conservatives start to trail, maybe even fall into within a tie with the NDP or even below the NDP, then it's going to be more complicated to see who is actually going to be casting ballots for the Conservatives. And there's nothing worse than an election with an unmotivated opposition. The best example is Michael Ignatieff back in 2011. You know, he starts the campaign at a very close number two to the Conservatives, and they wind up with less than one in five votes cast in the country. So the one thing for the Conservatives is not only to try to gain, but also to motivate the base to come out there and vote for them again.
The Trudeau Liberals are going to run on their record that they spent billions of relief dollars in 2020 to keep the Canadian economy from collapsing during the pandemic. O'Toole needs to prosecute the Trudeau Liberals as the most corrupt government in Canada's history.
And would that sell on voters?
It worked in a way for Andrew Scheer. That was a campaign, the one that we just had a couple of years ago, where all of the discussions were related to how the Liberals were behaving, ethical dilemmas, the problem with SNC-Lavalin. It actually allowed the Conservatives to have more votes than the Liberals, but not more seats because of the intricacies of the system. There might be a way to try to connect in fashion, but I think part of the difficulty for the Conservatives the last time around is that they didn't sell an image of what the country could be. And, you know, we're looking into something that happened way before the COVID-19 pandemic, but still there was no clear vision of what a country under Andrew Scheer would be. And I think there's an opportunity for Erin O'Toole to start to talk about other matters. I think part of the difficulties that he's faced is that he's been all over the place. There have been certain things that have been pleasing the social conservative wing, but not really the morally conservative wing. And it's been difficult to try to make sense of the party as it is because of the mixed messages. But ultimately, I think the one thing that they have in their favor is that they can be critical of certain decisions and things that have happened under the Liberals. Is that going to be enough to entice people to say no to a party that they believe has handled this pandemic well? We'll still have to wait and see.
Jagmeet Singh will be in his second campaign as NDP leader, but the NDP brand in BC is under fire. The Fairy Creek old growth logging protests, the mishandling of the June heat wave, and now the wildfires. With the Greens imploding, will the NDP lose votes in BC to the Liberals?
What we see here when it comes to the relationship between the BC NDP and the federal NDP, there's parts of it that can be seen as a blessing and there's parts of it that can be seen as a curse. The biggest problem is when we look at the results of the last provincial election, a lot of those votes were votes of confidence for how the pandemic was going. It wasn't necessarily people who voted for the BC Greens or the BC Liberals or the BC Conservatives moving to the NDP because of ideology. They were happy with the way this pandemic was going. Now it's the federal Liberals who are in that position. So a little bit of that change, if you're not going to be voting for the person who is right now as your MP, is going to hinge on that. And that takes maybe the idea of seats going from conservative to liberal, and even from NDP to liberal, to a higher level. So it's very complicated, because if a lot of people in BC vote based on the fact that the pandemic was handled well by the federal government, then it's no longer a question of ideology, it's a question of management. And the other difficulty that we see for Jagmeet Singh is, and we saw this a couple of years ago when we were doing surveys before the last election. He's always seen as somebody who's very affable, who's very knowledgeable, somebody who has favorable ratings, but it doesn't always turn into votes for the NDP. And, you know, this is something that happened in the first couple of elections under Jack Layton as well. You know, he was seen as more charismatic. He was seen as somebody who was more down to earth. He was seen as the person who you wanted to have a beer with, but he wasn't seen as a person who you wanted to lead the country. And that is going to be one of the major challenges for the NDP. Can you sustain a situation where the campaign might actually take your favorability ratings into the 60s or 70s, but it's not going to take your vote total into the 30s, which is what you need to be competitive.
And finally, I asked Mario Canseco about his poll on the winners and losers in the post-pandemic pro sports business in BC.
Well, I think there's a couple of factors that are making this. One of them is the inability to watch the sports live. And, you know, that is crucial for people who want to spend money and to go to the stadiums and the arenas. And they can't even do that if they're going to be going to a pub or a bar to enjoy it with a friend. So your ability to spend money on sports is already a little bit limited. And part of what happened is that other jurisdictions were certainly quicker to come back into sports. And we saw it with Major League Baseball last year. We saw it with the NFL. So the sports fan in British Columbia is looking at other things. They're looking maybe at European soccer as well. They're looking at the NFL. They're looking at Major League Baseball. Because the ability to relate to the games that we grew up watching and going to the stadiums for has been taken away from us. Now, that being said, whatever happens with the CFL in the next couple of months is going to be probably the best case study that we have for how the situation related to vaccine passports is going to work. We know that they have a very dedicated fan base that is always at the stadium, and the fan base is mostly over 55. So we're assuming that these people have already had their two shots and are going to have an easier time navigating through the post-COVID-19 world when they go to the stadium. It is going to be crucial to try to figure out a way to get younger people into the stadium. I think that is going to be one of the challenges for the CFL, and it has been for some time. But there's a difficulty in establishing that relationship with sports if you can no longer go watch them live. And I think that has affected particularly the Whitecaps, but to a lesser extent, we see it happening with the Canadians as well.
Meanwhile, biking, hiking, camping, boating, and golfing. Outdoor sports and recreation has boomed in the pandemic.
One of the things that is going to be interesting to watch in the next month or two is how Canadians relate to the Olympics. We will not have anyone other than the athletes and their coaches traveling to Tokyo. There's not going to be fans in the stands, at least at this particular point. Are we going to relate to the exploits of the athletes in the same way that we did before, especially when, because of the intricacies of the pandemic, you have a lot of professional athletes who have decided to sit this one out? We have a lot of members of the NBA Dream Team in the United States who say, I don't want to play in Tokyo. I don't think it's safe. The best hope for a medal in tennis, Bianca Andreescu, has decided not to play in the Tokyo Olympics. So what is going to happen? Is this actually going to be something that Canadians continue to follow in the same way that they've done before? Or are we also a little bit done with the Olympics because this edition is going to be so different from the rest?
That was my guest, Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. Find more information at researchco.ca. And an update on the story that rocked the nation about the former Kamloops Indian Residential School. On May 27th, Chief Roseanne Casimir announced the remains of 215 children were found via ground-penetrating radar. But on July 15th, the Tkamloops First Nation finally released the findings of ground-penetrating radar expert Sarah Bolio. Bolio, a professor at the University of the Fraser Valley, scanned around an apple orchard from May 21st to May 24th, the same area where, a couple of decades ago, a bone and a tooth were found. Her report was not released, but her PowerPoint presentation clarified the issue. There could be the remains of 200 humans, but that can only be confirmed with excavation.
Phases heard of 215 potential unmarked graves. We just want clarification. 200 anomalies now. Is it more of a, are we understanding now more of the actual grave sites as opposed to what we first saw in late May?
No, nothing's changed. With ground penetrating radar, we could never say definitively that they are human remains until you excavate, which is why we need to hold back a little bit and say that they are probable burials. They are targets of interest for sure. They have signatures, multiple signatures that present like burials. But because of that, we do need to say that they are probable until one excavates.
Very good. Thank you.
Also commenting was Roseanne Archibald, the new chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
These are crime scenes, and so we need some kind of independent investigation. We know that, for example, the RCMP are a part of children being taken from their families and communities, and so we need some kind of independent investigator on this process. And we need also international examination into these crimes. We did have a recent resolution passed at the AFNAGA on the International Criminal Court being involved in this process. The federal government, in one way, is in a conflict of interest because it was their policies that actually initiated residential schools in Canada. At the same time, they have to be accountable. They have to be responsible. And so these are conversations that I am going to be having at some point with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and members of his cabinet.
Kamloops Indian residential school survivor Emily Camille has other ideas for what should happen.
Those remains should be left undisturbed. I had tried to go down there to say prayers, but I couldn't even cross some line. And I still would like to do that if I could get permission from whoever is responsible to look after the site to say prayers.
The Breaker.News will continue to follow this story as it evolves.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbians, past and present. Why? Because July 20th is the 150th anniversary of British Columbia joining Confederation, the day that Canada expanded to the West Coast. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine, I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine, because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 18th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 18th in 1976 in Montreal, Romanian Nadia Comăneci became the first gymnast to score a perfect 10 at the Olympics? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.